Welcome to the Safety Podcast, where we connect health, safety and environment to keep you learning, evolving and having a positive impact. Thanks for taking the time to join us for this episode. Let's get started. Hi there, thanks for joining me here in the Safety Podcast. This week we have a bit of a cheeky content reuse because I was on a webinar just last week there, the guys over at Engage EHS, which used to be formerly known as Effective Software. You might otherwise know it as Effective Software. They've just rebranded at the start of the year here. They invited me on to their annual webinar to discuss some hot topics around health and safety for the year. Myself and Bridget Leithley from The Safer Choice were kindly invited on to the webinar to have a chat with Dara Gagan, who is the CEO of Engage EHS. So what I wanted to do was just republish that as a podcast and let you guys listen to it to see if there's value in it for you. Hopefully there's some value in this conversation for you as you move into 2020. We touch on hot topics like mental health. We look at the accident stat trends over the last year or two. And also we touch on business continuity planning in the context of all that's going on the global scale at the moment and what you should maybe be thinking when it comes to that for the business you're working in. Before we go on to the webinar, just want to mention a bit of a plug here that we are building our first course at safety.com. It's going to be on risk assessment. So if you're looking for a course on risk assessment for your staff, your employees, or even for yourself, then this is going to be a useful little one to refresh your memory. Or if you're completely new to the concept, then it'll be something that you can use. But also, as I say, if there are people, managers, supervisors in your business that would benefit from a short course on risk assessment, then this could be one that would appeal to them. There is that ever-burning question of online courses versus classroom courses. And in my experience, a lot of the digital or online courses are a bit poor, to be honest. There are some really good ones out there as well, but what we wanted to do to make this different, because we really care about the outcomes of the students, is to offer an online course with lots of video and engaging content and activities, but also to add that personal touch and make sure that every student that sits it is getting value and taking away some learning from it. I'm going to be giving a consultation follow-up to every student that sits the course to go through the topics and ensure that they're happy with everything that they've learned. So hopefully that's going to add lots more value to that process for you if you are designating courses and trying to upskill people when it comes to health and safety. So if it's something that you think would be good or much better than what you currently have, then please do keep an eye out for it. We'll keep you updated on it via the podcast and via the website. We really appreciate your support with that. So let's crack on with the podcast this week, which is our webinar with Engage EHS.
Okay, welcome everybody to the 2020 Health and Safety Checklist webinar with Engage EHS. It's our first webinar, I believe, as Engage EHS. So those of you who are aware, we've rebranded recently, so for previously Effective Software. Delighted today to have a couple of speakers with us to go through some key topics and looking at kind of the 2020, what's going on and some key areas to focus on. So we have Richard Collins, who's a consultant and director at Safety Limited. Richard runs two well-known health and safety-focused podcasts, the Safety Podcast and the Safety School. And Safety Limited provides health and safety, environmental consultancy, media, and digital support across various sectors. So welcome, Richard.
Hi, folks. Thank you for having me.
And we also have longtime collaborator, Bridget Leithley. So Bridget, owner of The Safer Choice. Bridget's a freelance health and safety consultant, provides risk management support in numerous environments and delivers safety training, and also writes for numerous publications, including ourselves.
Pleasure to be here.
Great, great to have you. Myself, Dara, I'm the CEO with Engage EHS, and I'll just be facilitating the conversation really with the two guys today. So, maybe people online are familiar with the blog that went out, so I think today we're going to be focusing on some key areas from that blog. There's, I suppose, three key areas today that we're going to focus in on. There was more in the blog that Bridget had wrote, so there was a lot of information in there, a lot of information focused on 2020, but today we're going to just pick out three of those topics, because it would take probably a lot longer for us to talk about everything, but the ones that we're really going to focus on today: sickness and accident stats, a view on mental health, and then looking at business and continuity planning as well. So they're kind of the key areas that we are going to focus on today and work our way through. So we might just jump in and start off with the sickness and accident stats. So I suppose it's a little bit of a view back on 2019 and a view towards 2020 and what people really should be focused on. So some of the information that Bridger brought in the publication, really, if we look, we had 147 fatalities in the UK between April 18 and March 19. That's up year on year, so it's an increase in fatalities. The agriculture, forestry and fishing is an area where the most fatalities have occurred. Previously, that was construction, so that's a change in industry. And Bridget might sort of talk us through some of that, and Richard as well. 1.4 million workers were suffering from work-related ill health, which led to 23.5 million working days lost. And it was an area where there's the leading cause of work-related illness was stress, anxiety, and depression, and it's an area that's been increasing year on year. So I suppose we're gonna ask the guys to give some opinions and insights around those areas, and we might just start with Richard first, if that's okay. And Richard, maybe give us your insights into kind of what was going on last year and maybe what we should be focusing on then for 2020.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to pretend to know what everyone should be focusing on. But certainly from my own experience, using that high level data can be really useful. But just it's important to stay conscious of the fact that it is, you know, at high level, and it can be used in conjunction with your own specific data, I would say. And it's important, if you can, to drill down into the sector-specific stuff just for that more focused lens, you know, that you can then use to apply to your own business or organization. And things haven't really changed that much. I did actually an article myself on it and looked at the stats recently. There hasn't been a huge amount of change on it, but a couple of things to pick out and things that I'm hearing back from people as well in terms of what to focus on, and I know it's been mentioned on the blog as well, around remote working for one, the changing nature of work and the evolution of technology, I think, is leading towards more people being able to work on their own, you know, with that technology in place. And that in itself is becoming a bit of an issue from a health and safety perspective. And I think it is a blind spot for a lot of organizations. It's easy to sit sort of for a lot of us to sit in a cozy office during normal working hours, and when it's out of sight, it's out of mind. But I think for everyone, you know, it's important to just really understand how the work is being done within your business and taking into account all of the working hours, the travel distances, the physicality of the work and the impact that that has on the people and the resources that's being provided for that. The flip side of that is that there are great communication tools and monitoring technology out there, and I've used it myself in the past with businesses and working directly as well, you know, to help that communications piece and to stay in contact with those people that are remote or are lone working. So definitely, you know, I would say to take advantage of that and be aware of that.
I think that's an interesting point, Richard, in that, like, a lot of the time, obviously, we think about high-risk lone workers and we think about lone worker, you know, monitoring, but yeah, there are more and more remote working, and that's kind of it's a much wider scope, I think, perhaps less high risk in some areas, but it's a much larger part now of the working population, right?
Yeah, I think to an extent there's more of it, but I think to the same degree we're becoming more aware of it, that it is an issue, if you know what I mean. And I get a lot of feedback from people looking for support on that particular topic. So it's a good thing that it's come into our field of, you know, vision, but obviously we want to be proactive and make sure that we're putting in the right support systems there for the folks that are impacted.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Bridget, obviously you've collated a lot of these stats and done the research around this as well for the blog. Have you got any insights there to give?
Yeah, I think the one thing to say about the fatalities is, although you mentioned, Dara, that they'd gone up slightly this year, it's not a statistical difference in the same way that there isn't a statistical difference between 48% and 52% when taken over the population of the UK. The difference has been fairly minor. So I think what you need to look at is the trends, the longer term trends. And the HSE also produce fatality figures for a sort of 5-year average. Yeah. And they have kind of plateaued out a little bit, and there has always been this attitude, and I'm sure Richard comes across this as well, where some people say, well, there are just some accidents that we can't do anything about. Some accidents are just unavoidable. That's just that, you know, we can't get the job done unless we take some risks, and that means that things will happen. And I think that the fact that rather than seeing it as agriculture, forestry and fishing going ahead of construction, see it as construction falling behind. Actually, construction have actually taken some of those accidents that previously people said, there's nothing we can do about it. And they have actually said, well, actually, we can do something about it. We can reduce falls from height. We can reduce incidents of people being hit by machinery and vehicles. We can reduce those accidents. So I think that's the really positive thing that all industries, whatever sector you're working in, can take away from it. That if construction can do something about it, then if you run a food processing plant or you run a shop or whatever your business is, you can do something about those accidents that appear to be unavoidable. So I think that's the first thing to say. I think the second thing to say on the lone workers one is that yes, I mean, a lot of the deaths in agriculture are people working on their own. A lot of them are self-employed. So that does link back to kind of issues of the gig economy and so on. I think that I'm very in favour of using technology, and some of the devices for lone workers are fantastic. Yeah. But, and there's a very big but here, giving somebody a lone working device tells you where to find the body. You know, it doesn't deal with the initial hazard. It doesn't actually eliminate the initial hazard. So, I mean, the case that we've covered in another blog on lone working is one with someone working in a water utility company where the job that they were doing was unnecessarily dangerous. Whether they were doing it on their own, whether they were doing it with a buddy, whether they were doing it with an audience of 10 people watching. Yeah. That the underlying risk of that task, and it was after the death, they changed the way that the inspection hatch was covered such that nobody could fall through it anymore. So, you know, the device... I mean, the problem with the device in that case was that actually it didn't send out an alarm until he hadn't contacted them after 2 hours. So he was already dead by the time the call went to the call centre, and it took another 2 hours for anybody to get there. So the devices are like a bit like a high-vis jacket. You know, they're only the last resort. If you can keep people away from machinery or vehicles, that's better than putting a high-vis jacket on them. If you can make the lone worker's job inherently safer, then we should be starting with that. You know, any of these topics, it's always identify the hazards, identify who can be harmed, yeah. Eliminate them at source if you can. So I think that's the kind of two key points I'd like to draw out of those two sets of data.
And I mean, this is a question off the cuff, so you may not have the answer to hand, but just in terms of that, as you do look at those kind of 5-year averages for construction, are they very much on a downward trend, and that is why you see agriculture kind of going ahead?
There had been a downward trend. I think a lot of these are beginning to plateau now, but yes, certainly construction has been on a downward trend since the sort of turn of the century. Yeah. But I think it is beginning to plateau out now. I think the other thing to draw from is that actually what the construction industry has done in the last couple of years is it's now saying, well, actually we've reduced the number of fatalities to, you know, I think it was 30 last year, but the number of construction workers that very sadly take their own lives is higher than that.
Yeah.
So actually, if you want to protect the greatest number of people, well, then maybe you should turn to you know, why do we have such a huge mental health problem in construction? And, you know, some of that is to do with the fact that people are working away from home. It's to do with some of the issues that Richard mentioned about fatigue management, working hours and so on, pressures on work sites. You know, we know that the construction industry has been under pressure because of the financial climate that we're in. So there's all those other pressures going on. And so I guess, you know, maybe... We sort of, there might be some tweaks on the fatalities from accidents, but actually the biggest impact that can be made now is actually reducing the respiratory problems that people have with dust, reducing the manual the musculoskeletal problems, and reducing obviously the mental health problems.
Yeah, and as well, like you said, obviously the sort of stress, anxiety, and depression now becoming the leading cause of work-related illnesses, and that kind of, I suppose, maybe brings us on to the next slide, which is when we do look at those kind of mental health areas, we'll talk about that in a second and where a lot of that's, you know, where that's coming from. So I suppose just maybe to finish up on those key areas that we talked about in the 2020 plan and key things, you know, the action plan for next year? What do people need to look at?
Yeah, so I think with the review arrangements for lone workers, I mean, we have got a more detailed blog online. I think that one's online now, which takes you through the sort of steps for reviewing arrangements with lone workers. And again, I think it's really important to go to identify what you mean by a lone worker, because I was at an IOSH event recently where I think quite a few of the health and safety professionals there were sort of thinking, oh, I hadn't thought of those people as lone workers, but it might be people who are staying in the office late, staying in a lab environment late, people who open up a shop in the morning or close a shop at night after the other people have gone home, that all of those people, even if for a very small part of their day, become lone workers, and therefore you need to think about the hazards that they face and have perhaps buddy procedures in place. The buddy procedures can be quite low tech. I mean, I've certainly known of groups and staff where they have a WhatsApp group and they all kind of contact each other, you know, whoever's left at the end of the day contacts the others to say, yep, the place is empty, I've gone home, I'm safe. Yeah. So it doesn't have to be a high-tech solution for you know, depending on what your situation is. But yeah, I think everybody could just have a look and go, are there any lone workers? Do I have anybody who's working on their own? I mean, even if you're a self-employed consultant, I think sometimes you need to look at yourself and think, when are the times when I'm on my own, and who would know where I am if anything happened?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, I agree, guys. And I think something to be very aware of is, you know, a lot of the time there are people working on their own, but they don't really need to be. And there hasn't been enough forethought around, you know, planning that work in a way that creates an environment where they can work with other people, or the work can be done at a time where there are other people around. A lot of the time that is the case as well. So it's something to be aware of, you know, just from a planning perspective as well. Mm.
Yeah, so you eliminate it as being lone working in the first place, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, slips, trips and falls is something that I think, you know, the BP explosion kind of gave slips, trips and falls prevention a bad rap, because the accusation was that, you know, big process plants were concentrating on slips, trips and falls to the exclusion of major hazards. And clearly, you know, major hazards need to be dealt with, but there's an awful lot of people still falling over. And, you know, this is the kind of nuisance level stuff that is quite easily avoidable with a little bit more sort of forethought, making sure that people know where barriers are kept, making sure they know where cleaning equipment is kept, that they know how to get in touch with the cleaner if something needs to be cleared up quickly. It seems mundane, it seems trivial, but it is, you know, when you look at the non-fatal accidents, this is still the biggest cause of the non-fatal accidents.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, good insight into those kind of, you know, early indicators can give real gains to reducing major incidents. Absolutely.
Yeah. Then yes, the last one I think is the one we're going to sort of move on to in a little bit more detail anyway. So, you know, it may be that mental health issues aren't a problem in your organisation. It may be that for you it's workplace asthma. It may be that it's musculoskeletal issues. It may be that it's mental health issues, and I think whichever one of those it is, you know, you need to, like with any other hazard, you just need to have it identified. I found there's quite a lot of resistance when I've tried to build in some of the health issues into risk assessments. People are quite okay with the conventional sort of hard health hazards. So if you ask people about noise in their workplace, they're happy to include that on their risk assessment. If you ask them about vibration, they're happy to include that on their risk assessment. But once you start asking people about some of the musculoskeletal, it's like, oh well, no, they do manual handling training, that's fine. Or mental health, oh no, everybody's happy here. It's quite hard to get organizations to build those into their risk assessments.
Yeah, no, fair point. Okay, we'll move on then maybe to so that's a segue into looking at that kind of mental health statistics, and that was another area that we focused in the blog. So I suppose there was a Bridget raised a valid point in the article, really, that many companies still don't have sufficient analytics to identify maybe classifications, root cause, you know, of the incident type. So you might be tracking stuff, you might be reporting it, you might be getting it in, but oftentimes you don't fully understand where a lot of the root cause is coming from. And certainly in terms of improvements or deterioration in performance based on the action plans you've implemented. So that understanding, I think, of, you know, capturing that information and making sure that it's understood in the right way can lead you to identifying these areas for focusing within your own business. But one of the mental health statistics that we kind of picked up on, 60%, and this was a UK construction survey, so 60% of the people surveyed suffered from mental health problems due to the job. So again, that really harks back to that increase in kind of mental health issues that have been raised. Financial worries, long hours, job demands, obviously all of these things feed into that. With 4 in 10 people admitting taking time off work for mental health reasons. And, you know, I mean, I might pose a question as well. Obviously, we can look at this and go, right, you know, are our jobs getting more stressful? You know, and a lot of people will say, yes, they are. We're working longer hours. We're doing more. We're more connected. We have less opportunities to shut off. Or is it a case that in some cases it's more acceptable now and there's more help available, so people are more willing to report these things, where, you know, 20 years ago in industry, you probably couldn't go to your boss and say that you were feeling stressed or feeling anxiety, or it certainly wouldn't have been dealt with in the way that it might be dealt with, or the help that was there now. So, again, we might hand over to the guys for this kind of discussion around that, and maybe this time we'll start with Bridget, if that's okay.
Yeah, okay. Yes, I think we can't possibly tell whether it's improved reporting or whether it's actually a bigger problem. I think that's a very difficult one to unpick. But I think what's important is that, I think there was another survey where it was Institute of Personnel where actually a lot of organisations weren't actually recording people's reasons for sick leave. So they would report in sick, but whether that was because they had a cold or flu or bad back or whether they were stressed, whatever, the reasons weren't being recorded. So I think that's one of the first things is, and I know sometimes if you're in a health and safety position in an organisation, it's not you that is is managing that, it's the HR department. But maybe that's a conversation for health and safety professionals to have with their HR departments and say, well, do we collect this data? Do we ask people why they're taking time off work? Then I think that the key to me is just with any other hazard, it's, you know, identify the risk factors. So this is from, unfortunately, this HSE publication is no longer in print and the new one doesn't have such nice drawings in it. But I think this just really summarized for me, you know, it should be treated just like any other hazard. So what is it that's causing the stress in the first place? The stress management standards have been there for a long time. I don't think they used anything like as much as they should be. The HSE have got masses of information about stress management. They've just come up with a new publication called the Talking Toolkit, which gives you some ideas. If you have a team meeting, for example, once a week, then it gives you some ideas about, you know, week one, you talk about demands, week two, you talk about control, week three, you talk about support and so on. And you can work through that to actually decide, well, what are the risk factors that as a manager I have control over, or that the organization has control over? Because there are some things we can't control. You know, we can't control what's going to happen over Brexit. We can't control people's marital relations at home. We can't control all of those factors in their home life that might be causing them stress. But we can control all of these things that are listed here, and that those do have a huge influence, and that people can sometimes cope better with home stressors if they know that they've got a little bit of flexibility, a little bit of support at work. Just someone saying, how are you today, might make the difference in that sort of situation. But going back to that flow chart, if we go back one from there, it is that thing of, first of all, identifying what those factors are, looking at who could be harmed by them, evaluating them, discussing the solutions. Now, it's always the case with any hazard that the solutions to your to the hazards that you've identified should be something that you discuss with your staff. If it's a recurrent slip hazard, actually talk to your staff and say, well, why is this slip hazard occurring? Is it something leaking? What do you think we should do about it? Would you prefer to clear it up? Would you prefer to get a cleaner to clear it up? With stress, that's even more important that you talk to people about what the solutions are, because if you impose a solution on people, you can get the kind of the law of unintended effects. So, I don't know, you decide that actually the problem is shift work. So you say, right, we're going to change the shift patterns because people obviously work. You've read some study that shift work at night causes stress, so you get everybody to work a day shift. You find out actually that doesn't fit in with people's home lives. They might like working nights, they might like working a late shift. So you do need to explore those solutions with the people impacted. And then we're back to the usual, record what you've done and then monitoring it. And I think another interesting one with that is a lot of organizations have accident, incident, near miss reporting systems. I've not seen many organizations where their incident and near miss reporting systems include anything to do with stress. You know, they don't sort of, people don't go, well, this happened, this project was late, someone didn't deliver on time, that led me to be very stressed. I've never seen those sort of reports coming up in a near miss reporting system. So I think
there are a couple of customers that would have looked at that, but you're right. I mean, the numbers are very small.
I mean, it'd be really interesting to talk to organisations that have tried to do that, because I think it's a really positive step if there are people out there trying to do it. Because I think the key thing is what guidance do you give the staff on what to report? Because, you know, neither do you suddenly want just people using the reporting system to whine about their colleagues or their boss. Yeah. So how do you guide people into making reports that you can actually do something useful with? And also all the issues about data protection that come with that as well.
Exactly, ensuring confidentiality, making sure that you're not kind of, you know, sharing information or even highlighting information that might be easily identifiable to a particular employee. And I think that's a key area people are kind of concerned about.
Absolutely. So I think for me, again, it's a little bit like, as with lone working, you know, the devices are fine, but actually it's about identifying the hazards in the first place and fixing them rather than just... you know, I used to teach yoga, but I still think that just giving people free fruit and yoga lessons and saying you need to become more resilient is not the way to manage stress. You know, it is actually understanding what's causing stress in the first place.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Richard, anything to bring in around that?
Well, Brett just covered some of the things, you know, that I would agree with in terms of this isn't, I think it's a big opportunity for health and safety professionals, but it isn't easy. You know, getting results from absence reduction isn't a case of, you know, changing out a piece of equipment or changing slightly how you do the work, like it is with injury prevention. But I believe there is a huge opportunity there. I mean, we go back to the stats that we talked about earlier around absence rates and what causes it. You know, stress and all those things related to it are a massive proportion of that. Obviously there's a lot of detail and behind, you know, those figures in terms of what's actually causing it. But as Bridget was mentioning, you know, I don't even think this is optional in terms of if we're going to have an impact here, we have to be coordinating, we have to be collaborating with human resources, but also with all the other management departments to find out what is really happening in the business, what is it really like, and what is the organization doing to create a stressful environment for employees. You know, only then, when you find out the truth of the matter, can you have any chance of making an impact on improving it. You know, but sometimes whenever you open your eyes and you ask those questions to the right people, the people on the ground, the people that are supervising, the managers, you know, it'll become very apparent that there's something obvious. I mean, there's somewhere I worked before myself where just through, for whatever reason, over time, you know, all of the production in the business was sort of loaded onto the back end of every quarter. And this was just, this problem actually stemmed right up from the commercial team and sales, and, you know, bled right down through the organization to the point where we were on the front line trying to manage higher risk, higher stress, due to the fact that all this production was trying to be done within a 2-week period at the end of a quarter, and it was completely unnecessary. You know, obviously there's business reasons for making that better, but also from a health and safety perspective there's huge benefits in changing that, and we did actually change it, and we spread the load across the quarter going forward from the point that we realized, you know, the issue. And it was highlighted as, you know, it was a safety issue primarily, and that's where, you know, we made the ground. But it is about talking to people, and the health of your relationships within your organization, I think, will influence the quality of the information you're going to get back. So, you know, it's really important for us as health and safety professionals to, as I always go on about, build those relationships, you know, gain trust with people, have those difficult conversations, and hopefully you'll get that information. But as well as Bridget was saying there, I totally agree. I'd written something down that's very similar, you know, in terms of mental health and well-being within an organization. I think, you know, adults, and as a parent of a couple of kids, it makes me think about it as well. Adults like to be controlled no more than children do. And I think that regardless of what's happened in the past, we really need to try hard to place trust in people, give them autonomy to work, under a framework that we're happy with, but give them autonomy to work. And I think that will yield much more positive results than being authoritarian and giving them a yoga class every fortnight to make them feel better. Yeah. That's the reality. So,
Both in terms of productivity as well as, obviously you give people autonomy and ownership, the productivity can really, boost. They'll find better ways of doing things, and then obviously looking at it across the business as well.
Yeah, and I think that's the point we make in the blog, isn't it? Is that if you've got all these people taking time off, then that's, even if you don't care about their mental welfare, that's just a cost to the business, isn't it? If people are having to take time off as the only way of dealing with the stresses, then you're losing productivity. So
yeah, no, definitely.
I noticed there was a question on here about, well, there were sort of two questions: who should lead the mental health program, and also someone asked about mental health first aiders. Mm-hmm. And I almost think those two sort of things combine together. That I think the mental health first aid. I mean, I've done the 1 day course. I'm booked on a 2 day course. I know there's longer courses as well, but I'm not sure that it's akin to first aid, because if I came across, Dara, you hurt your hand and I'm a first aider, I'll get the first aid kit out and I'll put a bandage on it. Whereas actually with mental health first aid, it's actually more of an identification, that you identify that somebody has a problem. And so for the way for the mental health first aid schemes to work is that you've done all of that initial, let's see if we can reduce the problems in the first place. And that also the mental health first aiders have the backup to go, right, I think this person has a problem. I know who to refer them to for the actual help and the treatment, because you're not training mental health first aiders to give counselling or to provide other support that people might need. But I think the other really good use that organisations could be making of the mental health first aiders is in that first stage, in that if they are the people who are going out there and looking for the problems, whereas somebody might not be able to say, well, actually the reason I'm feeling really down is because my hours have changed or because we've got this new computer system. If they've talked to the mental health first aiders about some of those problems, maybe they can feed forward, well, actually this is what, believe it or not, this is what's causing stress. I remember a really trivial example back in the day when I was a union rep, where they changed over from vending machines having money to vending machines having cards. Mm-hmm. And the number of people that came to me saying, I'm finding this really difficult because I don't want to have to card. I want to just be able to put money in it. And it's amazing how sometimes trivial things can cause people an amount of stress. Yeah. So I think using the first aid is in that way. I think maybe the problem with the mental health first aiders is actually the title was always wrong, because they're not trying to fix people. They're trying to identify who needs help and then point them towards the resources they need.
Yeah. Yeah. No, interesting point. And I think you both raised some really good points there in relation to, even some of the operational side of things that can really lead into the stress, there's a lot of things within a business where I think perhaps safety can be involved in, where we can make improvements. But again, it's understanding, like you said, that where the time off is coming from, where that lost time is coming from, and having some information around that to help you make decisions as a safety professional is what you can do to help. Absolutely.
I think, sorry, Dara, as well, for safety professionals, it's a really difficult challenge. And depending on what business you're in, there may be, responsibility directed towards you in terms of tackling this. And I'm sure someone's asked the question, who should be responsible for it? And really, you need to go to the top of the organization and get buy-in and be really honest about the amount of support that you can provide. It needs to be a coordinated effort, and you need to be very aware of the resource needs, and it needs to be a long-term approach as well if you're going to have an impact. And I agree with what Bridget was saying in terms of the first aid, is an administrative control. If we're thinking about a hierarchy of control here, and that's something that should be there as a backup measure only, I would say.
Yeah, no, very good point. Okay, so in terms of the couple of bullets we had here for kind of action plans on this, anyone want to pick up on those?
I think reiterate what I've already said, really, which is the HSC have an amazing number of resources on their website. Tackling work-related stress one was one that came out last year. Even this morning I checked, and there's another resource on there which I say is about talking about stress with your staff and gives you some ideas about how to talk about it, because that can be a difficult topic for managers to raise. And then working with your staff, if you have mental health first aiders, working with them to say, well, what do you think we can do about the problems?
Yeah, pretty good.
And I think, there's always going to be that problem that some people are going to react differently to pressure than other people. Some people can cope with the same pressures better than other people. Mm-hmm. But it's making sure that everybody is given they can perform to their best. They're a valuable resource. You've spent money recruiting them and training them. Let's see how you can keep them in the workplace.
Very good.
Okay. Yeah, I would just add to that. Going back to my example, just ask yourself. And I think this for HSE professionals, again, is a big opportunity to add real value to the business. And you guys have touched on the fact that, this is a fiscal financial impact on the business, whatever way you look at it. So the question I would ask or get people to ask is, what practical opportunities exist within your operations that you can influence or change to alleviate that pressure in a way that can be sustained?
Yep, absolutely. And I think you made a very good point around the, obviously with that financial impact, you need to get buy-in from the top. And to do that, you need to be able to put business case together and have information to back that up. And I think so understanding all that information, presenting it in a way that shows both the personal impact and the business impact, I think is important too.
Yeah.
Very good. Okay, thank you guys. Okay, so we might move on to the last point for today, which is looking at kind of business continuity. Now, when Bridget put the blog together and we were focusing on some areas for 2020, we primarily spoke about terrorism, maybe some of the protests then with the Extinction Rebellion, environmental concerns, but all of those still very relevant. But obviously the world moves at a very fast pace and there's a ever-evolving threat to people and to business. And obviously the start of this year has presented some serious issues for, on a personal level for a lot of people and also for a lot of industries as well. So we have, in the start of this year or the tail end of last year, we've had the Australian wildfire outbreak, which, while there may be an annual sort of element to that, they do suffer from that and have an impact on that every year. This year has been absolutely devastating, I think, for a lot of the people there and for wildlife and for business. So, I mean, $4.4 billion of cost, the estimation, 500 million animals killed, 33 people dead. Just absolutely devastating. And obviously that poses, threats and issues for anybody dealing with, people going over to and from Australia. And then the coronavirus, a global verging on epidemic, but it's been sensationalist, but obviously there's a significant risk across, it's now 564 people dead. It's in several countries. There's a lot of travel has been shut down. There's confirmed cases coming up daily and a lot of and more fatalities, which is, again, devastating. But there's so much business, I suppose, between Europe and China as well, that it just poses that additional risk. And it's something that companies have to deal with as well as individuals. So, there's been a lot of change since that blog. And maybe we'll touch on some of the things that were talked in the blog as well, but maybe focusing on some of those new and emerging items as well. So yeah, maybe if we start off with Richard this time again, and maybe give us some thoughts on that.
Sorry, did you say Richard? Dara, yeah.
I did. Yeah, if you want to.
Anyways,
I was going from one to the other, letting one person at a time. But by all means, yeah, if you want to.
That's no worries. Our names sound very similar over Zoom. no worries. That's fine. Yeah, I mean, this is a challenge for, again, health and safety professionals, depending on your own organization. I know there are probably people listening that have been involved in this and others that haven't. In my experience, it's either one extreme or the other. Either you're not involved in the conversations or else you're given complete responsibility for it. So I suppose with that in mind, I think that yes, you should be involved in it, absolutely. But again, as with the mental health issue, you should be very conscious over where you can add value and what resource you can put towards it. If you're a one-man health and safety team, then you have to be conscious of how much time and effort you can put towards this. And I think businesses, once they look at this, and it's more so larger businesses that look at PCP in my experience, in any detail, businesses are very inclined to go down or fall into the trap of making specific plans for events that are actually very unlikely. But with that said, threats on the global scale are real. As you were saying there, Dara, you know, it's hard not to feel as if you're sensationalizing things when you speak about things like coronavirus or the bushfires. But, you know, in my own experience, I've worked in global organizations where there have been plants hit by hurricanes or, you know, severe flooding and shut down production. And the knock-on impacts of that to the business have been really, really heavy. And not only to the business from a financial perspective, but of course to the people. So I suppose the question to ask is, what risks are out there that could have an impact, and what type of impacts, you know, would they be? And can you have any, you know, any impact in terms of planning ahead of time for that? And that might be things like, I mean, we're all already seeing on the news here about the supply chains from China being hit really hard in terms of the ability to actually manufacture. I think within Europe there today, they're reporting that. So from two perspectives, you know, from a health and safety professional's point of view, what impact would these types of events have on your employees in terms of increased workloads or pressures or, you know, direct ability to even come to work? And I suppose with that in mind, flexible working and the ability to work from home or work from other locations comes into play. Having that agility can be really beneficial. But also just acknowledging, you know, what sort of impact that would have and understanding what way your organization is set up and, you know, how impactful that would be and what you would do in the event that something severe did happen. But also the supply chain end of things, although it may not be your direct remit, is something to be conscious of as well. A lot of us have, you know, systems that need to be serviced and supply chains that are required for critical safety systems, which may be impacted as well. So, you know, that's something that can be delved into, and where I think health and safety professionals can add value and ask questions. Questions to ask would be, you know, how much redundancy do we have in place for keeping systems up and running? You know, are we using single source supplies in our supply chains? Can we make that better? Those types of questions. But it's a big issue to tackle. Although I think, you know, without being sensationalist about it, I think we do need to, as health and safety professionals, play our part in it and make sure we're doing what we can to add value.
Yeah, I think that supply chain risk assessment piece is huge, and it's a, you know, obviously the larger organizations do tend to focus on it. There's not always the resources there to drive down through the full supply chain and do full risk analysis from top down, but it's an area that people do have to focus on, and it's definitely emerging as a core concern, I think, for a lot of businesses.
And I think at the very least, you know, when it comes to the global threats and health issues, you know, you might have people that are traveling for work or even just traveling outside of work as well. You know, the very least that we can do is provide them with relevant information to help them, you know, take care of themselves. And I don't know what people on the line think, but I would rather be seen to be too concerned than not to be concerned at all when it comes to some of these things, you know.
Of course, yeah, absolutely. Bridget, anything to bring in on this?
Yeah, well, I think as a one person health and safety team myself, I think there is quite a lot that a health and safety professional can do with actually quite big issues, because I think what we're very good at as health and safety professionals is asking the right questions. There was one client I was working with over quite a long period of time in a health and safety role, and I kind of nosed my way into their business continuity work. And what I was very conscious of was that they were asking questions about, they had all these sort of quite detailed plans about low probability, high hazard events, so like fires and explosions. And yet there were sort of some very simple things that I thought they should have been asking. Now, I obviously didn't know the answers to the problems. That was for other people to work out. But I did feel at least I could point them in the direction of saying, well, how many staff can you run this building on? What's the minimum number of staff? Because there might be all sorts of reasons why people don't come into work. It might be because of the virus. It might be because of Southern Rail, as happened quite a lot in London for over a period of time. So what is the minimum number of people we need? Which jobs would we switch to which other jobs? And those sort of contingency plans could apply to a whole range of hazards. Another thing they'd never looked at was there was some issues with water on one occasion, and it was they'd never actually sort of thought, well, okay, if we have a limited, let's just say the water supply is cut off, does anybody know how big the storage tanks are? How many times can we flush the toilets before we run out of water? Again, how many staff would we keep in the building? Which priority staff would we keep in? What order would we send people home in so that we could keep services running as long as possible? It's not that as a health and safety professional, I needed to know the answers to those questions, but I think what I was able to do was say, well, these are the questions you should be asking, is planning how you're going to deal with these things. Because if you don't plan how you're going to deal with those emergencies, you could have issues. So if you don't have enough water, you have quite sort of strong welfare and hygiene issues. If you don't plan which staff are the priority staff or which staff can move to other roles, there could be sort of safety critical things that are not being managed. So I think there is a lot that even as a sole health and safety professional, you can do to help in those quite big issues. Restrictions in travel is another one, Richard mentioned. I was a small company I was giving some advice to. They had, I think that the set of countries they gave me to look at was Hong Kong, right in the middle of the protests. I think it was one of the, it was the UAE, somewhere like that. And New York, which is fairly straightforward, but there were a number of troublesome countries that they were sort of sending staff out to and saying, well, what are the rules? What should we be doing in these situations? And again, you can point people towards the right information sources to manage those hazards.
Yeah, not very good.
And I think it is, as I say, so I think it is interesting that we think about, everybody has a fire plan, but actually, do we think about floods? Do we think about transport delays and strikes? Do we think about terrorism, what effect that could have? Even if the only effect of terrorism is, someone's left a bag on the train and the train's delayed, what impact does that have on people? And then, of course, the recent things with the viruses. I mean, one of the big issues with managing the when you have these flu outbreaks is that culture of, there were some dreadful adverts, I think, for one of the hot lemon powders or something like that, where it was like, oh yeah, I came into work even though I had a stinking cold. Look, aren't I a hero? And we have to get away from that culture of people coming into work when they're ill, because clearly that's how these things spread. So working on improving that culture that, no, if you're ill, you stay at home, you don't spread it around.
Yeah, and look, again, for certain roles, that remote working and being able to dial in and use technology to assist in that facilitates the, okay, I'm well enough to work, but actually if I do still have some kind of virus, then I'm not going to go into the office and spread it around to people. Been smart about what you do. Mm-hmm. Very good. Okay, so in terms of the couple of action points that we had around this, anyone want to pick those up?
So I think if you go into too much detail about the actual thing that could cause the problem, you can actually get yourself bogged down with, well, yes, but could there be an explosion? Could there be? If you actually think about the resources that you need to run your business, so you need people, you need water, you need heat, you need lighting, you need transport, what do you need to run your business? And rather than worrying about what could stop those things happening, because those are the things you don't have the control over. You don't have control over the terrorist attacks. You don't have control over the River Thames flooding. You don't have control over the weather. But in all of those situations, if you were short of people, short of water, short of power, what would you do? How would you manage those situations? So I think that's where the plans should be. And those need to involve as many different departments as you can get involved with it. And as I say, I think health and safety professionals are in a good position to chair those meetings and draw those resources together.
Very good.
Yeah, I agree. I think you sort of wrap that up nicely, Bridget, with, again, what I was sort of saying about your critical systems and making sure you have redundancy in place. That is an excellent point that you make about not getting bogged down in specific scenarios, because it's impossible, to be quite honest, to go into each of those and just look at how your business operates and make it as robust as you can, with the least impact on people. I think that's probably a good direction to go in.
Mm-hmm. Very good, absolutely. Guys, it was an absolute great pleasure talking to you both. Thank you so much for your input. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And if you are anyone online that are looking for maybe more information or in the blog that was written, it's up and available on engage-ehs.com. There is more up there, like Bridget said earlier, about loan working and some deeper information around that. So feel free to check out the site for some more info or hit us up with any questions. So thanks. So thank you all for attending, and we look forward to the next one.
That's it for this podcast, folks. Hopefully that conversation was valuable in some way to you. I'm sure lots of the topics were really familiar, but hopefully it was useful to get our perspectives on the different subject matter. I did actually interview Dara Gagan on his own. We discussed engagement for an upcoming podcast, which I hope I'm going to be able to release next week. We did have some sound issues on my side of the audio, which I have to deal with, which always takes a bit of time. But keep your ears out for that if you'd like to hear a discussion on engagement, if you're trying to really engage your audience internally this year. Dara, obviously, with running the software firm and trying to help his customers with engagement, has some great insights from that. So that'll be hopefully a useful discussion for you as well. So as I was saying at the start, keep an eye out for that risk assessment course that we're going to be releasing soon. We'll look forward to hearing your feedback on it. Hopefully it'll be useful to some of you guys out there. And until then, take care of yourselves and good luck. Thank you once again for joining us for this episode. We really hope you got value from the content. If you'd like to provide us with some feedback, which we would obviously love, please take a minute to rate and review the podcast on whichever platform you're using. Also, if you enjoyed it, please hit subscribe to make sure you catch our future episodes. And of course, share it with anyone who you think may find it useful. For more free resources and to find out more about what we do, you're always welcome to visit us at safety.com.